Hello and welcome. I'm Claire and you're listening to Microbe Talk, the podcast by the Microbiology Society. The Microbiology Society Annual Conference 2024, taking place in Edinburgh, is less than a week away. But if you can't wait for the exciting microbiology content, this episode of Microbe Talk might just tide you over. For this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Klas Kirkella from University College Dublin. He's a historian of bugs and drugs. He researches the history of microbial environments, public health and antibiotic and vaccine innovation and regulation. Klas will be giving the hot topic lecture at this year's annual conference, which is called Fecal Flows, a very short history of microbiology, sewers and Britain's rivers. Ahead of his lecture, I spoke to Klas to find out how he's feeling and to pick his brain about his intriguing research area. I wanted to find out not just what microbiology can do for history, but what history can do for microbiology.
Hi, I'm Klas Kirkella. I'm an assistant professor at University College Dublin, where I research the history of infectious disease, antibiotics and vaccines, and bacteriophage and microbial environments.
Amazing. We have you obviously on a Microbe Talk to talk about your upcoming hot topic lecture at annual conference. I think it's great to start from the beginning, really. How did you feel when you got the contact to say that you have been invited to speak at annual conference?
I was obviously delighted. So I've been in my research working quite intensively with microbiologists for a long time. And it's always been an absolute joy to engage with the community because they're so open towards interdisciplinary work. So it was both really exciting to get to share some of my research there, but also a bit daunting, to see how the wider community reacts to a historian teaching microbiology, I guess, like the history of microbiology in this context.
Yeah, but I think... So, before I get ahead of myself and I ask loads of questions, could you briefly explain what your hot topic lecture is about?
So it's going to be called Fecal Flows. I was tasked to talk about dirty rivers. I guess that's a hot topic in the UK at the moment.
Yes.
And I thought, there are obviously many ways in which rivers can get dirty, be it industrial pollution or human pollution. But obviously the human pollution aspect of it relates the strongest to my own research. So I thought I'd combine my interest in typhoid with my interest in microbial ecologies and really talk about the longer history of humans and specifically British humans' relationship with their rivers, how they've managed them, but also how this engagement with the broken ecologies of rivers, which have been a mainstay over the last 200 years, really, have shaped the evolution of microbiological research in the UK and have also really driven insights into ecological dynamics, but also potential solutions and biotechnology applications coming out of these river systems.
Amazing. So it's not just talking about the past as well, it's about how the past can inform the future. Is that right?
Yeah, I guess, historians are always a bit careful about saying, there are super easy lessons to learn from history because usually people have already learned those. But it's about really gaining insights from these longer term path dependencies that have been established. So it's perhaps breaking down unrealistic expectations for solutions, but also warning against short-termism when it comes to shaping fixes, going for overly financialized solutions to managing public goods in the UK. And I think all of these discussions are really pertinent at the moment from a policy perspective. But again, I think the lecture, what I really hope to do at least, is to integrate this talk about rivers as broken ecosystems, also with a deep dive into how microbiologists have engaged with this environment and, what kind of insights and what kind of applications have come out of it.
Exciting. And you mentioned kind of having a bit of nerves about speaking to microbiologists. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
I mean, I think the beauty of any interdisciplinary engagement is that you never completely know what the other side will take home from your own side in terms of your own expertise and also what kind of questions you end up getting asked. So, again, I've collaborated with parts of the community for quite a while now, but I think having such a large audience and such a diverse audience within the microbiological community means that... It's difficult to know the reactions to it in terms of really just the questions, the impulses I get back out of it. So I think that's that's part of the really exciting part of giving this lecture.
I'm also interested to find out about you. What led you to this specific area of research?
Chance, in many ways. I trained very classically as a medieval historian.
Okay.
And when doing my undergraduate training in Germany, I became absolutely intrigued, especially in the medieval period, about how vulnerable societies are to their environments, and how societies in turn shape those environments. So this endless interaction, this endless evolution of, you know, human cultures and environments around them. So that got me really interested in environmental history, and through chances, was fortunate enough to obtain a post that in Germany, what was then called the Rachel Carson Center for the History of Environment. I became a modern historian. And long story short, after going to the US, I came to the UK to study and got a Wellcome Trust grant to study the history of antibiotics, regulation and resistance in food production.
Okay.
And I initially did that really classically, just, you know, the kind of politics of it, the economics of it. But I increasingly got drawn into this microbiological data behind it, but also this rapid evolution of microbiological knowledge in the 20th century. And I endlessly read the same thing about phage types, and I had no idea what phage types were. So, you know, I started looking up what are bacteria phage, and got sucked into this world of how people in the 20th century start making sense of these incredibly complex microbial environments around them. And how it's not a linear heroic process of, you know, knowledge accumulating and people getting better and better at managing this, but actually how it's often ecological crises or collapses that actually lead to insights about things that have gone wrong, excessive stresses, etc. And in many ways, that's also what this lecture is about, is that, you know, microbiology, it's opening the door on an incredibly complex ecosystem that is in and around us. And how humans have eternally tried to make sense of that, and also to manage this without wrecking everything around them. And sometimes we've been more successful, and sometimes we've been less successful in doing that. And I think with rivers, we're you know, in many ways back again at one of these moments.
Yeah, because it's multidisciplinary research is, again, another hot topic at the moment, isn't it? About how researchers can collaborate together, and you don't have this kind of like funneled thinking of only within your own sort of research area. But I would say that maybe history isn't necessarily the one that usually comes to mind when you think about microbiologists collaborating. Why do you think that's important from kind of your perspective?
I think because microbiologists are becoming increasingly involved in writing history themselves. And I think that since the last 10 to 20 years with metagenomics, but also the phylogenetic revolution taking off, a huge part of the microbiological community has really become engaged in thinking about long-term history, long-term evolutionary trends. So the goal is in many ways to help microbiologists be critical about their metadata, so to avoid sampling biases. But at the same time, by tracking the history of these microbial flows that have reached the freezers of the microbiologists I'm working with, we can start linking the genomic data that we're getting out of the microbes with specific selective events, specific individual crises, such as mass displacement of populations, the introduction of a new antimicrobial, the mass production or falling prices of specific antimicrobials over time. And so what we end up getting is a much richer history of microbiology and microbiota in the 20th century than we could achieve if it were just one discipline working by itself. I guess that's where I see the niche of the historian with the niche of the microbiologist coming together, you know, really exploring exciting new terrain.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting. From kind of, I suppose, a complete non-microbiologist myself, because I suppose a lot of microbiologists might be forgiven for thinking, well, data is data. Scientific data is a different, I suppose, to kind of historical data, because that can be kind of either interpreted in the wrong way or it could be incorrect. But I think it's really interesting what you're saying about the marriage of them together, and that actually microbiological data could also be kind of biased in certain ways. And that's really interesting. Have you come across it in the past where perhaps the historical data has gone against what we've found, what the microbiological data says?
To give you two practical examples of things working either way, so microbiological data challenging historical accounts of disease and historical data perhaps raising some doubts about the metadata that scientists are using. One is the classic case nowadays of sequencing of Yersinia pestis leading to new chronologies of plague expansion, but also really pushing our knowledge of different routes of plague transmission, not just from the east to the west. So this old Orientalist cliche, which many historians were still going on about, but also leading to new insights about perhaps the persistence of different plague reservoirs, specifically in Europe. And this is what we've come across with archaeological investigations of plague symmetries, but also as a result of that, then phylogenetic sequencing of ADNA that was captured from these sites, really challenging existing written down chronologies of the plague as contemporaries experienced it. And I think specifically with regards to the history of the Black Death, but also the Justinian Plague, there have been significant rewritings that have resulted from this new hard genomic data coming in. Now, from my side, I work a lot on typhoid, and I've worked now quite intensively with Institut Pasteur, and they've got a fantastic collection, a very large culture collection of typhi samples dating back to the early 20th century. And one of the things that we've been doing there is we've been looking at how this archive was composed, and when you're sequencing it, how representative these samples actually are of wider typhi environments during this time. So in the French colonial context, colonial officers were sampling in hospital sites. These hospital sites, they weren't accessible to the wider population. They were highly urbanized where they were taking these samples from. So as a consequence, it limits our ability to actually say how typhi looked outside of highly mobile urban centers in rural areas where it might have been persisting in very different ways. So it's being able to be critical of these sources. Also, perhaps to read how different crisis events might have impacted what we're seeing in the phylogenetic data. So, for example, when we look at typhi samples from Vietnam in the second half of the 20th century, we're dealing with a lot of displaced people coming in first from the north to the south and then from the south dispersing to other areas. So it's about being able with historical data, with other records like demographic records to reconstruct those flows of people, to then interpret critically what we might be seeing in terms of the phylogenetic data points. And we're never really dealing with many of them. It's not as though we have hundreds of samples from this time. Often we're talking about how to make sense of five or six individual data points for one area per decade. So having this rich historical context is absolutely key. And perhaps to just end on another example is historians are also really good at finding collections that might have been ignored. So in the World Federation of Culture Collections, we only have a very, very small sample of collections that are catalogued globally. And the same is true for the international reference collections. If you're knowledgeable about the history of public health and who's doing what at different points in time, you're often quite well placed to say, well, there seems to be a highly relevant collection in this location. Can we go there and perhaps see if there's still a freezer around or if people still have records of these older sequencing efforts or phenotypic typing efforts?
So just to potentially track it back slightly, so you're talking about kind of your particular interest in, is it like the origins of typhoid, the history? What's your kind of interest there?
So I think with typhi, the really interesting thing about typhi is that it's human restricted. So if you look at where typhi is going, you're always looking immediately at human history. And in the 20th century, you're also looking at the acceleration of antimicrobial resistance or AMR over time. So what my personal dream would be to treat a microbe as an archival document. You know, I open it and I see inscribed within its code certain selective pressures or stresses that human societies have imposed on their microbial environments. And that doing that entails working closely together with microbiologists to get a representative sample of these different microbes over time, you know, in different locations where I can reconstruct these stresses. And then see how the resulting data either confirms or doesn't confirm my hypotheses about specific selectors in that environment being, you know, anthropogenic selectors during this time.
So So obviously you can go through and there are clues within the genome of the microbe as to kind of how they've evolved. But you also mentioned about kind of archival samples. I'm assuming you're talking about those as two separate kind of investigative techniques, right? Or are they marrying together? Like, how does that work?
So it's complementary. Usually focusing on one thing leads to research on the others. Another thing that we can start doing is, and this is now thinking about my interest in bacteriophage, is that we can start looking at where lost collections might still be. Phage are remarkably stable if preserved even outside of freezers. And so by looking through the historical record, seeing who was, for example, using bacteriophage typing at different points in time, I start getting quite reasonably informed guesses of where lost typing phage might still be, but also bacterial reference strains on which these typing phage were trained. And with Pasteur together at the moment, we're trying to identify many of these samples of typing phage and the bacterial host strain to layer an account of a host range evolution over time. So to reconstruct how phage are driving bacterial evolution, but also obviously how bacterial evolution then drives phage evolution, etc. And so that's, I guess, an interdisciplinary question that we can answer, where history, being able to find these collections, being able to understand where they came from, when they were created, helps improve biological data. And for the historian, what's super interesting is also that by reconstructing these flows, I get a history of 20th century microbiology, right? A microbiologist needs microbes to work with. So by reconstructing these flows of microbes from different territories over time, you know, the transfer freezes over time, I end up actually reconstructing how microbiology as a wider discipline, public health as a discipline, evolved in the 20th and 21st centuries.
Wow, that's so interesting. And it's great to hear you talk about how the disciplines are informing each other and that there's lots to learn either way. I think that it's a two-way street and you're helping each other, and I think that's really fantastic. A cynic might say, and this is not me at all, I promise, a cynic might say, so what? Like, you found out about the history of microbiology and these specific kind of diseases and microbes. A cynic might be like, what? So great, that's great for history's sake, but what does that actually mean for microbiologists today? And what would your answer be to that obviously rubbish question?
It's not a rubbish question at all. History is not a science, right? We deal with stories. We deal with them in a critical way. We deal with them in an empirical way, but we don't get to go back in time and pose hypotheses. You know, we don't get to rewind the clock and conduct an experiment. So we are dealing with a very different form of data from the hard data that we're getting, for example, from genomics. That being said, I think two things are very important to appreciate. That is obviously that the hard data from microbiology changes quite a bit with technological evolution going forward. So going back 10 years time, for example, previous molecular clock dating, you know, all of these things are also subject to change over time. So it's not as though I think science is delivering us with data that eternally remains firm, right? New technologies, new ways of approaching it lead to shift. So there's also a bit of flux there. But perhaps more importantly, and this is where history can, I believe, really help a more critical, more equitable microbiology evolve, is that history can show that microbiology, just like every other science there has been subject to structural inequalities. When it comes to how we read the world, how our own values inform the questions we're asking, but also inform the values we assign to data. And to give you a nice example of this, one of the pieces of research that is coming out right now is based on going back to lots of the phenotypic typing that was done in the 50s and 60s and 70s of typhi strains, when people were really trying to understand what is normal. What is a normal universal strain of typhi that we can use for vaccine design and for diagnostic design? Now, to ask you a very simple question, where do you think microbiologists at the time viewed normal universal strains should reside?
Oh, we'll be like Europe and England, right?
Exactly. So what we get is a phenotypic type assignation of universal or cosmopolitan strains,
yeah,
which have to exist in Western and North America, and cannot, and so no universal type can be ascribed if these strains do not exist in Europe or North America.
Yeah.
So there's no correlation here at all with overall incidence rates and overall disease burdens, which leads to the selection of a strain, the so-called quail strain, that has been used to calibrate both diagnostics, but have also been used as the challenge strain for all vaccine experiments since
wow.
then. So that strain okay. is not representative of typhi diversity in the high prevalence areas of the world. And yet, microbiologists, it's now described as well-characterized. But why is it well-characterized? Well, because it's a strain that also impacted white bodies during that
wow.
period. So these structural aspects, these structural biases are encoded in the taxonomies we're using. They're encoded in the well-described strains we're being handed down from history. And they're also encoded in the archives, right? So if I now do a retrospective sequencing phylogenetically of microbes back in time, I'm only dealing with the microbes that were there, where rich enough microbiologists were there, you know, who could sequence them and then pass them back to freezers or other storage facilities in Europe. So that's a massive historical bias. And in that bias, our predecessors were subject to exactly the same racist biases, cultural biases, gender biases that all of the rest of society was also subject to during this time. So those things are inscribed in the data sets that we're using. And robust critical historiography, both qualitative and quantitative, can really help us explore these biases and really also improve by medical research going forward. If I may, I don't know how much time we still have here. I mean,
I have all the time in the world to listen to you. this is so interesting.
The other thing involves the creation of surveillance systems for infectious diseases. Now, I've already talked earlier about how new genomic data is challenging old Orientalist cliches of diseases always coming out of the East, right? From non-white people hitting white people. And this is not just due to the fact of racist cliches and Orientalist cliches during this time. It's also due to how our surveillance infrastructures have been created over time. And in order to understand nowadays where the gaps of, for example, surveillance systems for pandemic preparedness are, we actually need to go back and understand how current sentinel stations, sentinel monitoring sites, are usually the result of convenient infrastructural choices. So these infrastructures of surveillance, they're saddled onto old colonial outposts, they're saddled onto places where resources historically have always been. And they aren't necessarily there where the diseases happen or occur, where there's the greatest diversity of potential outbreak pathogens.
Yeah.
So again, working with the microbiologists, working with this kind of mass of data that microbiology has been producing since the 20th century, we can go back and we can see, historically speaking, there has always been a blind spot here. What we have said about microbiota in a certain area is based on very limited data from one or two sentinel sites. So perhaps the next sentinel site we should choose should be one where historically we've always had a blind spot. So those are the things that historians can find out and where we can, I believe, have a positive impact on microbiology moving forward. And to just round that off with a concrete example of how that might happen is that I was very honored to serve for the UK COVID inquiry this year.
Yes.
And one of the questions they were very interested in was how the UK's infectious disease surveillance system had evolved prior to 2019. And if we look at the UK, so let's take it away from the kind of questions of colonialism and empire, just look at the UK, we see a historical preponderance for intensified surveillance and microbiological capacity in the south of England, away from population centres in the north.
Yeah. And,
I mean, I guess most people kind of guess this when you say it, but history can provide that hard data. This is actually hard data. Where we can really find out where these biases were and really point to the fact that this was a big gap that had consequences in our ability to have fine-grained public health interventions.
That's so interesting. I think, you know, science isn't always empirical and data changes. And what you've made so clear is if the origin of that data is biased, then your results are biased, whether you did them in perfect lab conditions or not. So I think it's really exciting then, obviously, that you're doing this lecture. If, say, for example, I don't know, like an early career microbiologist listens to your hot topic lecture, these kind of stories that you're talking about institutional biases and data, is there a way that they could incorporate what you're talking about into their daily work? Is there a way that they could think about what they're doing slightly differently, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the nice thing about history is it's actually quite, you know, easy to do in the sense that what it requires you, the baseline requirement, is to be critical about the context of the data that reaches you. I'm not making any claims about how well or how sloppy individual microbiologists work. I mean, historically speaking, there are lots of examples of both kinds of microbiologists. But I think what history teaches you is to be critical about the baseline assumptions that you have about your data. So if somebody says this is representative, a very easy question to ask you is actually, how do we define representative here? Is this data that I'm getting not just sound in terms of how it's been produced within a single lab, but also how that sample has actually been extracted from the field? That's one of the first questions you can ask, but you could also ask about the power relations inscribed in that data. So one of the big discussions that I have when I go to low-income countries or middle-income countries and I speak to microbiologists working there is the extreme frustration with the very long tradition of extractive microbiology that they've been exposed to, where they are there to collect samples, and those samples are then handed off to higher resource processing labs in different countries. And yes, increasingly they are allowed, in quotation marks, to be authors on these papers too, but they actually don't often have ownership either of the samples or of the resulting data. So they are seen, or they see themselves, as being forced into the role of data providers, but not necessarily into the more prestigious roles of data analysis. So when you're dealing with a sample, that sample, it has to have been collected somewhere. It relies on the resources of the infrastructure that have allowed that sample to be collected and to be brought into a lab. And that then also depends on geopolitics. Again, I'm happy to give a concrete example. If you're looking for lots of the plague samples and anthrax samples that we've got collected over time, many of these were collected because of biosecurity concerns and concerns and modeling about what biowarfare could look like. So every sample you've got, it's nothing is ever really representative, but all of these samples have been collected at one point or another with a logic of either defensive or offensive bioweapons capabilities moving forward. So it's the ability to just think through all of the steps that make a sample reach you, and also all of the steps that allow you to have the equipment to process that sample, that makes you, I think, perhaps a more critical and more reflective microbiologist. And again, I think, you know, I don't pretend to know how to do genomics. You know, that's not my job. But it's been fascinating with, and again, every microbiologist that I've spoken to has been extremely open and also self-reflective about this. But I think there's a hunger at the moment for these kind of interactions, both amongst historians and amongst microbiologists.
And you mentioned about like bacteriophages, and that in itself is a completely hot topic at the moment of the use of bacteriophage to potentially tackle this problem that is antimicrobial resistance. Are there any kind of specific ways that you think that history of bacteriophage could inform, you know, this new research that's happening at the moment and the use of bacteriophage as a treatment?
Unsurprisingly, yes. History offers many insights, and we've actually got a special issue in Phage coming out now.
Oh, wow.
On this, that's interdisciplinary. I think there are multiple ways in which this can happen. I think on the one hand side, I think history is a great antidote against over-enthusiastic expectations about what Phage therapy can and can't do. I've spent the last 5 to 6 years looking at more depth into the market models driving antibiotic innovation with a project with the Norwegian Research Council. And I think many of the insights also apply to bacteriophage, where it's both a scientific challenge, but primarily it's also a challenge about valuing or the valuation of different aspects of innovation within a system that isn't necessarily always geared to producing value in a public health sense. At the same time, the history of phage, because it's such an old technology, is also steeped in legends. Sometimes they're nice legends, right? You know, lots of the stuff about Felix Derrell reads like a, you know, glamorous movie of, you know, people moving to the Soviet Union and then, you know, other people falling victims to purges and things like that. But there is this persistent narrative that phage therapy somehow died out just because of antibiotics and how they came about in the West. And what we're finding now, and this is unpublished research that we're hoping to publish later this year with Institut Pasteur, that it actually never went away in many high-income countries. Even after 1945, patients were being treated with bacteriophage. We've got the clinical records of this. Wow. And in the case of a country like France, up to 100 people per year were receiving bacteriophage, either as cocktails or as tailored phage that had been adapted to hit the specific infection profile that the clinician was dealing with. So when it comes to the future of bacteriophage therapy and the current hype, I think it's very important that we consider alternatives to the antibiotic workhorses we're relying on so hard. But on the other hand, what we also look back at now, looking at close to 100 years of persistent data on different forms of phage therapy, is that phage are not antibiotics, and they will never be able to replace these antibiotic infrastructures that we've created. They can complement them and they can act as targeted interventions. But this hope that I think is often the case or expressed in media articles that are, you know, 2-minute reads, etc., that this is the forgotten cure, you know, the next big thing, is an overrepresentation of what phage, empirically speaking, have been over the last 100 years. They are complement. They are not a replacement of antimicrobials. So it doesn't replace the fact that we actually need to invest a lot more in stewardship and microbial management. You know, there's no kind of wonder technology or magic bullet that's going to save us.
Yeah. So do you think then, you know, learning about this history could also then inform and help with public opinion about phages as well? And having this historical use, could it potentially make the public feel a bit better about this phage research being introduced? Or could it then be like, well, we've been using it for ages and it's not worked? So, like, what do you think there?
I think historians are always frustrating when it comes to that. So it's a bit of both. I think I liked, I guess, it's like team realism. It's I think what we need is a realistic discourse about what phage can and can't do. I think we should be optimistic about the fact that there are actually plenty of different novel antimicrobial compounds and also phage remedies in the pipeline at various stages of the pipeline. But I think this optimism that we get every 2 or 3 months when we've got another media-wide report about the solution to AMR, etc., is that it endlessly displaces the more important discussion about the fact that AMR is here with us to stay, and that regardless of whether we have a functional phage infrastructure, which I hope we have, or whether we have new antibiotic classes or antimicrobial classes reaching the market, we will continue to be faced with this challenge of AMR, that we should start perhaps reevaluating the infrastructures that we rely on in both food production and health systems to become more resilient without needing recourse to these forms of microbial management. So to phrase that more simply, it's great to have technical fixes, but they don't alleviate the underlying structural drivers of microbial stress and AMR that we are creating. And I think that is the most important thing to get across here, because often, and this is a real historical insight from the 20th century, is that the hope for the magic bullet endlessly displaces the actual hard questions about the drivers, the inequities, the environmental stresses that are actually producing all of the problems we're facing into the medium to long-term future, because we're endlessly hoping for the next quick fix. And for Farage, that for me is one of the big challenges in the discourse surrounding them, is that we're both over-enthusiastic and in so doing actually end up also harming their ability to actually change things. You know, we're overselling them.
Yeah, I can see that. That's so expertly put. Well done. Like, that's really interesting. I've not thought about it in that way. You mentioned about kind of informing the COVID inquiry with your research. Obviously, scientists are limited in terms of what they can do with bacteriophage research. It's only really used as a last resort in the UK. Do you foresee maybe, you know, your kind of expertise or your colleagues or your area of research being used to potentially inform that kind of policy decision in the UK? Is that something that happens? I don't know.
So historians, I think, are fairly regularly consulted for some of the broader policy debates. I mean, obviously, we'd always like to be consulted more, and, you know, all of these things. But I think at the end of the day, history should have a permanent place at these tables, because in contrast to people modeling the future, we have an empirical past which we can draw on. So with regards to antibiotic innovation, that's been also a very nice experience for me. It's been a very open area, I think, because of this sense of pervading crisis surrounding different innovation models. There's been a lot of interest in history. You know, different models that have worked, that haven't worked. So there's been a lot of space actually there for historians to inform policy discussion. And with AMR too, it's been a great pleasure to see some of the work my group has produced, you know, being cited by the World Health Organization or by the World Bank when it comes to just warning about the structural drivers, essentially what I just talked about within this. Because again, none of these problems are new. I think if, you know, AMR has been with us since the beginning of the antimicrobial era around 1900, right? We've got the first reports from 1906 of AMR in labs coming up. So it's not new. I don't think historians are smarter in any way other. It's just that many generations of scientists have already bashed their heads against the wall when it comes to dealing with this. And unfortunately, we've forgotten about some of the insights that the previous generations have already achieved about how to approach certain problems. So it's playing this role as a Cassandra and saying, you know, this is a problem that won't go away like this. And here are five different evidences, bases from five different decades that I can mobilize here that are useful. And for the COVID inquiry, I think it's everybody likes to tell narratives about the past that are convenient. And I think that is particularly true in policy, where you always mobilize the past to justify the future that you're selling. And having a kind of fire break in there, or, you know, a kind of break that just slows down this mobilization of the past that is often very selective and just says, well, it's probably more complex, and actually there are some things that run against this narrative, is a useful thing to have when it comes to making decisions about what kind of future we want to have.
Yeah, that critical analysis is so important, because I think, you know, you mentioning about phage being used previously, my brain immediately went to, well, that's a good way of proving that it's okay to use it now. And that, like, appeal to history, I suppose, is just so dangerous.
I guess history is all we have, right?
Yeah.
So we need to go into the past to make informed decisions about where we want to go forward, because the past is our empirical basis of knowledge that we endlessly draw on. With the Farage aspect, again, it has worked, and I think we've now got enough clinical evidence from the present, but also from the past, to show that, you know, in specific instances, Farge therapy is a great way of treating and even preventing certain forms of infectious disease. But we have to be extremely careful about the narratives that this is a forgotten cure.
Yeah.
It wasn't forgotten. It just didn't take off because there were other structural constraints on it that we have to consider when it comes to formulating viable solutions going forward.
Wow. There's lots to think about. And I'm very much looking forward to hearing the other element of your research about the British waterways in the Hot Topic lecture. I have one final question for you. If you'd like for the Microbiology Society members to take away one thing from your Hot Topic lecture, what would you like that to be? It could be two.
I think the really simple thing is that wherever there is a microbiology laboratory, usually there's a historian sitting close by, in another building down the road. And that it might be a good idea with regards to any topic that you're interested in or researching to just invite them out for a coffee or have them invite you out for a coffee and chat about how your version of the microbial past, if you're dealing with it, intersects with theirs and what you can learn from them and what they can learn from you in turn. And I think that for me is essentially where all good interdisciplinary research starts, is this moment of exchange and just seeing the mutual overlaps.
Yeah, that's wonderful. A good coffee could save a lot of research, I reckon.
Well, or start it, right?
yeah, that's so exciting. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you. This is really interesting, and it has kind of changed my perspective a little bit on a lot of areas of microbiology. And I really hope that members have the same kind of reaction to listening to your lecture and your conference. Is it your first time? I'm assuming it would be your first time at our conference, by the way.
It's my first time. I mean, the funny thing is that I've been digging into the archives of the Microbiology Society now for my research and culture collections. But so it's a huge honor to actually be at the conference I usually just read about 50 years down the line. So it's great to be there.
That's really interesting. I would definitely come and track you down at conference and pick your brain. But thank you so much. This has been brilliant to have you on.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Take care. I will see you at conference.
See you there.
It was an absolute pleasure to speak to Klaas and discover a historian's perspective on microbiology. If you're at conference this year, Klaas will be giving his Hot Topic lecture at 8:45 on Thursday the 11th of April. If you can't make it, don't worry, Klaas's lecture will be available online after annual conference.